Welcome to the JIMD podcast, the companion podcast to the Journal of Inherited Metabolic Disease, the official journal of the SSIEM. In fortnightly installments, we bring you insights from experts in the IMD field, discussing everything from screening through to diagnostics and the latest updates on therapies. After 100 episodes, our extensive back catalogue should definitely have something to tickle your fancy, but for now, settle in to hear about Aicardi-Goutieres syndrome. Hello there. It's always a pleasure to welcome back previous guests to the podcast. And one of today's authors first joined us in the first year of the podcast talking about multiple sulfatase deficiency. And whilst I haven't managed to get her back discussing that topic, I'm delighted to welcome back Dr. Laura Adang from the Division of Neurology at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And Laura is joined by her colleague, Dr. Mariko Bennett, to discuss their recent paper, Nucleotide Metabolism, Leukodystrophies and CNS Pathology. Laura, it's good to have you back. And Mariko, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. We are delighted to be here to share awareness of a really important emerging class of disorders, which are the dysregulation of RNA and DNA that turn on the immune system, typically through interferon expression, and really cause systemic manifestations in children. Both Dr. Bennett and I are leukodystrophy doctors, which is how we got in here. And I was so happy Dr. Bennett joined us because she is actually an expert in microgliopathies, which is really the intersection of these type 1 interferonopathies and how they affect the brain is in the microglia. So it is my pleasure to have her come and teach me about microglia in the brain as well.
My favorite topic. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
I'm not sure I've ever met anyone who is an expert in microgliopathies. I'm not even sure I can say it, so I'm very glad I've got someone else who's going to do the hard work for me. I mean, so the title of this paper is Nucleotide Metabolism, Leukodystrophies and CNS Pathology, but it struck me that it's mostly about Aicardi-Goutieres syndrome. And I'm not sure I've thought about this perhaps since my membership exams, although occasionally I do see it on our ward handover lists. I didn't even realize it was an IMD. So what exactly is it?
Yeah, so I'll start off, but jump in, Dr. Bennett, as well. So back in the early 1980s, there's a beautiful paper by Aicardi and Goutieres, which described families that had congenital infections or what seemed like congenital infections that ran within the family. And the paper is beautiful. And really, even though they didn't have any understanding of the molecular underpinnings, was spot on. And that these families had inherited differences in how they were metabolizing RNA and DNA. And that was leading to a constitutive activation of the type 1 interferon system. So it looked like these children within the same family all had congenital infections, which we know is exquisitely uncommon, right? It's usually the first time the mom has the torch infection or the congenital infection that the child has the biggest manifestation. And within the next decade, they began to discover the various genes of RNA and DNA metabolism that were resulting in the cell essentially sensing that there was a constitutive or a chronic infection within the cell, activating this pathway. And so it was a cluster of genes that were brought together because of phenotypic similarity, right? And actually, at this point, we have 9 different Aicardi-Goutieres genes. And so it's become a bit of a basket where everything has been lumped together into a common core. But the more I work in this field, the more I realize that that boundary between what's AGS and what is perhaps familial Chilblain lupus is really blurred. And so you can have changes in these same genes and actually have non-neurologic sequelae. So I find myself more in awe of the complexities of it.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, one thing that's sort of important is that these systems that our body uses to sense viral infection are usually, you know, on the cellular level, detecting DNA or RNA, different nucleic acids that really shouldn't be there. And I think through the identification of some of these genes and also before that, and then the appreciation about sort of a disease manifestation with these mutations, we're beginning to understand more and more that these species of nucleic acids exist in our cells through normal processes of development and sort of refinement of the nervous system to the point of thinking about other phenotypes sort of in the development of every tissue in our body. And so as we are learning more and more about this disease, we say, you know, it's a brain predominant pathology, but we learn about these variable phenotypes in our patients.
Laura, you started out by saying that the initial observation was that it looked like congenital infection. I guess that's going to be a problem that clinicians are going to face every time this comes up. So if it does look like congenital infection, I presume it's quite hard to diagnose.
Yes. I mean, it can be, in the early phase, indistinguishable, right? And so if a child has congenital icardibutira syndrome, then they are born with inflammation that is an actual mimic of congenital infection because it is triggering the same pathways that, say, a congenital CMV infection would be triggering. And so these children can get thrombocytopenias, anemias, white blood cell count abnormalities. They can get hepatitis. They can get the rashes. They get the calcifications within the brain. And so to me, you go looking for the infectious pathogen. It comes up as negative. I will put an asterisk there where I think we deserve a little bit of a conversation about that too. And then it's an inflammation that doesn't go away. So unlike a traditional torch infection where there is an inflammatory period that's discrete within a child's life, in AGS, this is the inflammation that persists. It's the child that continues to have a hepatitis or blood count abnormalities months to years after that initial inflammatory event. And I want to put in the asterisks back again. I think it's complicated. And one of the things we have noodled on as a community is whether in some cases there is an instigator that makes a child have a more severe form of AGS compared to their sibling. There is very limited genotype-phenotype correlation within families even. And so is it an early infection that triggered the system, which was already overly sensitive to sensing abnormal DNA and RNA species? Is it an early infection that pushed that child over the edge and why they presented at birth rather than at a year of life? And we know that outcomes are really different. So as is true for really all the inborn errors of metabolism, the earlier it manifests, the stronger the symptoms are.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think it can be really tricky then because you're trying to identify sterile, meaning not caused by an infection inflammation, because the treatments are totally different. On the one hand, if it's an infection, the interferon is protective in theory. It prevents widespread, maybe viremia, if that's the case. And then in the cases of our type 1 interferonopathies, like Aicardi Gutierrez, we want to block all of that extra interferon because we know too much is really bad for you and leads to degeneration of the brain and tissues.
And I think that gets to the point that these are disorders of an imbalance. It's good to have an interferon response, but it's good to have a brief interferon response that your body is able to turn off again. And so in disorders like AGS, that regulation is off. Sometimes they're overly sensitive to different species, or they're unable to tag RNA as being self-RNA. And so there are lots of different mechanisms by which the 9 different genes of AGS all lead to really a very similar phenotype.
You're already starting to talk about treatment, but I wanted to come back to some of the other things that have been mentioned. You've talked about the different genes involved. You talked about this issue around genotype-phenotype correlation. So within the paper, you highlight just how many genes there are implicated in AGS. So how many are there now? Because I imagine this is the sort of thing that changes over time. And how much does the gene involve affect the phenotype? So not just perhaps changes in the same gene, but did different genes give different disease?
That's a great question. It's complicated. I think there are different complications or clinical trajectories that are more common with the different genes, but there really isn't a be-all end-all rule book yet that lets us know that a child with, say, a change in SAMHD1 is going to behave in one way and a child with TREX1 is going to behave in another. We know most children that have changes in TREX1, which is an exonuclease, are more likely to have very early presentation, but really any of the genes that they present early are going to have a more severe presentation. So it seems like age at onset is actually a much stronger prediction of neurologic outcome than the individual gene.
I think it sums it up perfectly. It's really complicated. I think as a young clinician in this space who knows a lot more about cells and molecules, I think trying to map that onto patients is really tricky. And of course, the dream. And the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And we're beginning to understand the same mutation, for example, in TREX1, could cause a severe disease in a neonate. and then maybe sort of linger until early adulthood where things start to go wrong and the rheumatologist says, you know, maybe actually you don't have lupus. Maybe you actually have something else that's in some genetic testing. And so we're meeting patients that are our age that we realize actually have achondroplasia gutierrez. So it makes it really tricky to pinpoint exactly the contribution of these mutations, especially because our cell and mouse models and other preclinical models tend to focus on we're just going to knock the gene out or overexpress it and then look at its effect on nucleic acid sensing and interferon. And that's really tough to turn that into a clinical judgment sometimes.
Given this difference between the different genes, when you look at congenital disorders of glycosylation, they started off with quite large collected groups, the type 1s and the type 2s, and they've now really separated out to reflect that genetic diversity. There's 190 of them now. They get named via their genes. Obviously, having a collective group helps from a community point of view, but is there an issue around trying to clump all these genes together? Should, I mean, I'm sure you can't speak for AGS completely, but would there be some sense in separating them and really thinking about them as specific gene mutations, or is it helpful to keep them all grouped together?
I think that's a brilliant idea and where I think it would be great to go as a field in the future. I think we really need a lot more fundamental understanding about these diseases, early prognostic variables, natural history, and how the course of the disease happens before I would jump into splitting what we have currently lumped together. But I think there will be predictive variables that we will be able to identify. We will identify biomarkers that help support stratification earlier in disease. And so I think we'll be there. We're not there now, which makes it really challenging when we meet a family who has one child affected and now a newborn who is also affected. Predicting how that newborn is going to be at 1 year or 5 years or 10 years of life is a really tricky thing. And we just don't have the fundamental understanding of the natural history disease and those predictive influences right now to give great anticipatory guidance.
I think that sometimes we're not meeting these families until their child is really affected because it was thought to be cerebral palsy or thought to be an infection, thought to be a different kind of a rheumatologic condition. And so when we think about what the genes are, I do think they're starting to fall into two categories. We just haven't really seen it manifest clinically. The two categories are really like genes that, when affected, modulate the STING pathway intracellularly, and then genes that seem to modulate sensing of abnormal double-stranded RNAs and mess up with RNA editing through MDA5 and MAPS. And so there's two pathways, but most of our readouts and our treatments are focused on not the cell that's producing that initial insult, but maybe the effector cell. So the cell that's being affected by the cell that's actually sensing the high amount of interferon that exists, but not necessarily the cell that's generating it. And so I wonder, as we meet some of these families earlier, if we detect this disease earlier, it's definitely on our mind here at CHOMP, that we might start to learn a little bit more about the early pathobiology and be able to stratify patients better before we get to the later stage.
I agree 100%. And I also think that our view of achondroplasia gutierrez and honestly, these inborn errors of nucleotide metabolism is overly reductionist to call it an interferonopathy. I think that that's what we have looked for. But if you actually look in patients, you get dysregulation of antibody production. Some of them have antibody-driven autoimmune disease. We can see things like ulcerative colitis and inflammatory bowel disease in these children. Hypothyroidism is common. Diabetes is common. You get B, T, and NK cell dysregulation. And so I think that's where the second table. And if I can talk about the paper, what I think is the biggest value of the paper and what I use day to day is looking at that massive table of mimics of these diseases. Because as we have AGS currently defined, we're looking at an overly reductionist view of how it affects children. And we've measured what we measure and we see abnormalities. But I think there are lots of things that perturb this pathway of immune regulation that cause a very similar phenotype. And so if you look at children that have classic AGS, around 15 to 20% of our cohort does not yet have a molecular diagnosis, even though they phenotypically look identical to my other families. And so there are clearly additional pathways involved in this RNA and DNA metabolisms that are causing similar perturbations of the immune system and are manifesting similarly. We just don't know them yet. So we have 9 genes today, plus a massive list of mimics of AGS, right? And I think over time, we will come up with more elegant ways to cluster them so we can predict and anticipate and guide and treat.
I'm assuming diagnostic bias is an issue here, because the problem being people aren't going looking for this. Mariko said that we have issues around a cerebral palsy case or a lupus case that only over time does someone go back to it. How could we improve diagnostic pickup? It doesn't sound like it's a candidate for screening outside of a molecular basis. You're making a face. Does that mean maybe it is a candidate for screening?
We're working on it. I mean, I think you could fundamentally identify inflammatory signatures. And if you look at the biomarkers that underlie this Ecarta Gutierrez type 1 interferonopathy family, they're actually somewhat different than acute infection. So I think there is the potential of someday having newborn screening to help to identify both congenital infections, but more importantly, AGS. So I don't think you'd have to go necessarily to a molecular underpinning. I think it's important with newborn screening to make sure we are anchored in the pathology of the disease. And so I think starting with an inflammatory screen for newborn screening will be really important, rather than going molecular, where then you're faced with this really broad phenotypic spectrum of AGS, including adults that are very minimally affected. And I'm not sure how, if I started with genetics, I would parcel that out in a clinical setting. Mariko, do you have thoughts on that?
I mean, I totally drinking that Kool-Aid. I mean, I think if we do it on a phenotype, it's going to help us more than the genetics. I think what happens in a lot of our patients is they have private mutations, right? So they're only one in the world that has it. We try to do some sort of in silico analysis to say, yeah, that seems like that would be a bad variant to have, but we have to prove it with the phenotype of, do they actually have type 1 interferon? Now, on the other hand, some of these conditions are not autosomal recessive inheritance. They actually are dominant. And so they have one variant of uncertain significance that we haven't seen in other people in the world. And so then we have to figure it out. And we don't know at time zero, and they don't have interferonopathy. You know, what is the next 25 years old or next 50 years old? So I'm in favor of, if we did a screen, we didn't necessarily start with genetics, at least yet, until we understand better. I wanted to say one thing, Laura, which I think you can comment on better than I, but it is true that it is a diagnostic bias and that we are a leukodystrophy center. And so this is what we think about. But when we think about the leukodystrophies we diagnose or the leukoencephalopathies that we diagnose, I think AGS is the most common. Is that correct? Is that still true?
Yeah, it's the most common molecularly diagnosed leukodystrophy. And not just because it has so many genes. It is much more common than we anticipated.
I guess we all need to be looking a bit harder then.
I think it becomes important as we're starting to develop therapies. And we also have many of the complications of AGS, because it causes systemic sequelae, are manageable, right? And so there's a real reason in AGS to know and understand. I will say it can be really hard to differentiate AGS from cerebral palsy from a neurologic standpoint, because oftentimes children experience a one-time hit to their neurologic system, right? So if it happens in utero, children are born with neurologic differences. If it happens closer to the year of age, it looks like they have a severe infection. Oftentimes they're misdiagnosed with ADEM. And after that point, they actually have a period of neurologic regression with partial recovery, and then a steady, very slow gain of new developmental skills. So not dissimilar to what you see after an infection. So you really have to be thinking of it, because it is a mimic of many different things that present in childhood.
Well, I like to think the podcast can at least encourage people to think of these more unusual things. You've started to allude to this being a treatable condition. We always like to hear about treatable IMDs. Is AGS treatable?
Yes, but we have a long ways to go. So we have been stealing and reappropriating from other conditions that are better funded and better understood to see how we can modulate the immune system in order to improve life. Our group has been using baricitinib, which is a Janus kinase inhibitor, in this population for, oh goodness, 7-8 years at this point. It's published. It helps. Universally, the families like it. It's not, I think, where I would like to land someday. I think all the time about how we treat things like high blood pressure or diabetes with multiple medications when the first one doesn't work. But for these complicated network diseases like Aicardi Goutieres, we think, oh, well, one drug. And I just don't think that's realistic. I think we need an arsenal or a panel of medications where we can really individualize how the immune system is most perturbed in a child, help them with the regulation. And if that doesn't work, move to the next medication on our list. And so that's where I would love to be in 5-10 years from now, is to have 5 or 6 drugs or more that I can pull from to really personalize how I help families feel better.
Totally. And I think just to tell a little more about the Janus kinase inhibitors or JAK inhibitor, we think of the JAK-STAT pathway as downstream of that interferon receptor. So there's a genetic mutation that we hopefully have identified. It causes a cell, we don't know which cell yet, to produce a lot of type 1 interferon that binds them to a cell's receptor. And that downstream of that, on that cell, that normally should be told, like, there's a virus here, don't get infected with this virus, maybe die, maybe mount an inflammatory response. We sort of block that response where it's at. We don't actually stop the production of interferon there. We hope, limit the pathologic effect of that high interferon. So it's a small molecule. People take it by mouth or by G-tube if they need to. But you can imagine if you have a big interferon storm and this train of interferon heading down the track, and we just put a block up for it, that if you were to get rid of that block, that train still has all of that momentum. Those interferons are still extremely high. And so these medications are not without risk. And this pathway is how our body normally senses viral infections. And so we just knocked it out, or we just inhibited it for a little while in the setting of still having high interferon in the body. We do think that we help a little bit with the interferon while you're on these drugs, because there's probably some feed forward that you have a little bit of interferon and it produces more and more interferon, but it's not a cure. So we have to be really mindful. And sometimes the kids have to come off of the medication because they had recurrent infections, or because their blood cell counts dropped, which could be because of the Aicardi Goutieres, or could be because of the baricitinib that we gave them. And so we really need more tools in our arsenal, because we know the genes and we know a lot about the molecular pathways.
So if something is there, but I think, like every answer you've given me this afternoon, it's complicated. So the paper is on inborn errors in nucleotide metabolism. It feels like all we've discussed is AGS. Is that all there is?
I mean, no, it's a huge list, right? So if you look at the number of disorders that affect neurologic development and are related to interferon dysregulation, the list is dozens and dozens and dozens. And many of them are exquisitely rare disorders for which there's just single case reports. And so I think it will be really important with that list we have in the paper to expand that list, to edit that list as evidence becomes stronger or weaker. It needs to be a work in progress. I think because these disorders are oftentimes instigated by infection, right? The natural trigger of interferons in the context of a system that's a little dysregulated already, sometimes it can be hard to tease apart, well, what's from the infection and what's from this dysregulation of nucleic acid metabolism. If you look within the cell, there's a dysregulation in, I think, every single organelle that can cause a type 1 interferonopathy. And so, again, we have lumped together this class of disorders as type 1 interferonopathies, splitting off Aicardi Goutieres, but many of the disorders in that list are really phenotypically identical to AGS. They don't happen to be in that list of 9, but I don't know what really is the substantive difference between them, because we have very clear continued questions about the cellular pathophysiology of AGS and these other disorders. And so I suspect in the end, in 10 years from now, with Dr. Bennett's work, we'll be able to stratify and really come up with much more sensical clusters of disorders that help us to anticipate treatments and care guidelines.
I'm looking at our list, which I really like. I think that what is noticeable is there's genes that we know are RNA and DNA sensors that are not on that list. And I just wonder if they're not on that list yet because we just haven't met the patient that has it. And so it's clear that these pathways are important for normal development. And so is that why for us, at least as pediatric doctors, we see the interferonopathies affecting development? But I think we're going to learn a lot more and hopefully it'll lead to better therapies for these patients.
I mean, I remember in medical school many, many years ago now, being struck by the fact that congenital infections or torch infections had more things in common than they had different from each other. And that really underscores the strong role of how inflammation can potentially hurt or injure the brain, right? There are so many common features among the torch infections, and those same common features are shared with this growing list of type 1 interferonopathies. Because they're all turning on the same system. It's just in the type 1 interferonopathies, there isn't a natural way that that system gets turned off again. And so it's being turned on and then just staying at a high smoldering level of inflammation. I will say, when I have walked in a room of an undiagnosed child and said, I know what your child has, it is because of the encephalopathy that comes along with AGS. Having a type 1 interferonopathy makes children very encephalopathic. They are awake, but not present. We call it the AGS fog. Mariko, I'm sure you've seen the same thing where you just walk in the room and you're like, I know this is AGS.
Yeah, I think either high seizure burden or it's AGS. I think we describe it to families, especially ones that are putting on therapies. They say, how long could this take? How long until we'll start to see an effect? And I say, it could be pretty fast, because I think what you might notice is it's possible that your child's been living as though they've had the worst flu of their life. And we all aren't thinking well when we have the flu, and especially a bad flu. We sort of are foggy. We're not thinking straight. We're really sleepy. It's definitely really hard to learn and do work and pay attention to things. And so I feel like when families go on these medications, the first thing I hear is they just are more awake. They're paying more attention than they were before. It's very striking.
And it can happen really quickly. So within a dose or two of starting Janus kinase inhibitor, you can see that fog lift. And then what I tell families is the hard work comes, right? That's when the children are finally able to participate in therapies and gain the skills and reach their full potential. It does not reverse the injury that has happened, which underscores the reason we have to have early diagnosis and better ways to predict the future. Because if someone is going to have mild disease in adulthood, I don't want to have them an immune modulation medication for the entirety of their lives. That has way too much risk. And so I need ways to tell a child is going to be at risk for early severe disease. And those are the children I would want to be aggressive and prophylactic in this immune modulation. Right now, with the tools we have and delays in diagnosis, we're really treating children after they have already had an injury and therefore are presented, and then they get the genetic testing and then they make it to our doorstep. And so we have a lot of space to improve in that early diagnosis, early treatment, and early stratification.
So it sounds like you're doing all the hard work on prognostication. What can we do to make sure clinicians are doing a better job picking this up?
I would say the combination of neurologic symptoms plus sustained inflammation in the body should raise suspicion for a type 1 interferonopathy. I think if you have encephalopathy with that picture, these type 1 interferonopathies need to be really high on your list. I will say the other prominent feature that helps me to identify a child at the bedside is pronounced dystonia. So many of our children have dystonia of their hands, feet, and neck. And so oftentimes we will walk in the room and see an encephalopathic child with dystonia, and it will help us expedite the genetic testing for these interferonopathies. Dr. Bennett, has that been your same experience?
Yeah, I was like, if you're not going to mention the chilblains, the skin lesions, it's really prominent dystonia. And why that is, I think, but how does like a whole body interferonopathy lead to a predominant brain disease? Even in the ones that are listed in our non-AGS interferonopathies, some of these are on our differential for encephalopathy as well. And so why is it that the brain is so affected? And there's a whole emerging literature about interferon tone is just generally higher in the brain, which I might not have predicted, right? I might have said it was in the liver or the gut where it's exposed to the external world a little bit more. But I think because of these pathways and how they're used, it seems to be the brain. And in particular, if we look at some of the at least infantile versions or neonatal versions of this, it really affects the basal ganglia, those areas of the brain that are very metabolically demanding, that require probably a lot of refinement and development early in life that might lead to higher levels of nucleic acid turnover and potentially why they're affected and why you see things like dystonia early on. So stay tuned. I think we're going to learn a lot, especially as we're able to put these diverse stories from families together into a bucket and then try to treat them and see what else is revealed.
And then the other thing I would counsel is as we are diagnosing more and more children with a broader and broader phenotypic spectrum of these type 1 interferonopathies, I think it is also important to meet the child wherever they are. And we have seen, even in an untreated population, gains of new developmental skills at unexpected times. And so it is not a traditional leukodystrophy. It is a leukodystrophy because the myelin is injured, and that's how it was radiographically first described. But it is not the same chronic degenerative process that you see in other disorders like metachromatic leukodystrophy or even adrenal leukodystrophy, which is a very inflammatory leukodystrophy. There is some degree of recovery and continued hope that I have in AGS, even for children that are quite affected. I have seen children learn how to smile years after the original event or start to use sounds to communicate. And so it is a population that requires lifelong intensive therapy and hope as well. It is a very different space than the demyelinating disorders and those courses. And so many of our families are told this is a leukodystrophy, and so things will always get worse year by year. And that's not actually what we see in AGS. It is a very variable course, and oftentimes children are either stable or continue to gain skills years after their original event.
I feel like I could talk to you two about this all day, and certainly I'll be looking to stay tuned and hear more about your developments as they come over time. If people would like to read this paper and see your list of these mimics and these different conditions, they can click the link in the podcast description, or they can go to our journal web pages and search for nucleotide metabolism. Really, all that remains is me to say, Mariko and Laura, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, James. It's always a pleasure. And we hope to be back on again. Maybe we'll talk about multiple sulfatase deficiency again.
That is the plan.
Or microglia.
Or microglia.
Thanks for having us.
We could talk about microglia. Do you want to?
We don't have to. No, we don't have to. Not today.
Another time. We can get it booked in. Excellent. And thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.